born in what, 1933?
1938.
38. Where'd you grow up?
Grew up in Chinatown, right at the corner of Main and Pender. And my father had a tailor store, so we lived in the back of the store. Mm-hmm. And used to walk the 3 blocks up to Strathcona. It was an interesting walk because in those days the poultry shops used to have their live chicken cages right on the sidewalk, so mm-hmm. you had to go by all the smell and the screaming of the chickens and so on. A lot of characters in those days.
Wow. Who were your friends when you were a kid growing up in Strath? Were they all the Chinese people living around here, or who were they?
Actually, some of them were other minority groups. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, we had a friend who was a Russian background, and we had mm-hmm. several that were Italian background. Mm-hmm. We had one from a Jewish background, one from a Japanese background. It was really quite cosmopolitan in that respect. It was interesting because as we got along with each other, we were invited to each other's home. So that way, for example, I was introduced to homemade wine for the first time. Mm-hmm. Got the idea of, it's nice to have wine with your meals.
Yeah.
And I even knew of an Irish friend. He was a very close friend of mine. I think at the time I went to school, which was like in the late 40s, I think I was in that era where there were still other European immigrants grouped there. And it wasn't until just after 1950 with the influx of Chinese refugees, then Chinatown became really Chinese.
Yeah. You know, was it noticeable when the new immigrants from Hong Kong started coming?
Yeah, because for one thing, I remember 1951, 52, they had a new Canadian class, and there were these, they were mostly male, but they were older male. And there was a lot of resentment between us and these new immigrants. And one of the reasons why was because we had treated them as quote-unquote foreigners. They also had cars that they drive to school. They were older. We were a little more streetwise, and we didn't really get along too well right at the beginning. And this was more evident during the winter when we had one heavy snowfall and we had these snowball fights. And normally when you have a snowball fight, it's all fun, but a few times when we had snowball fights, you can really see that all the Canadian-borns were on one side and the Chinese immigrants were on the other side. And, you know, we were really throwing these snowballs hard and furious. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them really got hurt by that. I can see that in retrospect, you know.
I mean, hurt physically or hurt?
I think otherwise as well, too, you know, because, like, they could see us, we're Chinese, but we're not Chinese, you know, because obviously we're brought up by a different society. Whereas with them, they want to be fit into the society, but we didn't really welcome them, you know, with open arms. Mind you, in time, I think, like, towards the end of the first year, you know, some of us became very good friends. I know that they had a lot of things to offer. I guess one of the peculiar things I remember about the new Canadians was that they loved drawing things. And I remember one fella, he loved drawing Walt Disney characters like Mickey Mouse, Goofy, Pluto. He was very artistic mm-hmm. in that respect. Also, they had a lot more energy in math and science. Like, in other words, they really seem to excel in that, and you can tell, you know. And I think that was another thing, you know, they were really intent in taking their education seriously, while as being in grade 7 and grade 8, we weren't that serious about it, you know.
So they were integrated into the classes with you then?
Eventually. Some of them did, yes, eventually, yeah. But at the beginning, like the very first year, it was a separate class altogether, and they really stood out that way, you know.
They stood up because they were older? Did they dress differently?
I think they dressed, you know, like they had like regular slacks and windbreakers. new shirts, that sort of thing. And also, they had a tendency, like, to get together and spoke Chinese, and of course, we didn't like that. In fact, I remember, like, even in class, when they did integrate with the regular class, if they were talking Chinese to each other, you know, the teacher would say, no, don't speak Chinese here, you're here to learn English, you know. And of course, we would pick up on that ourselves, you know, and we used to harp on that with the new Canadians. You know.
Was there any name calling? What did you call them? What was their name?
I don't think, well, other than the usual chinky chinky Chinaman, I think that's about as far as we went, you know.
Oh, you mean you guys called them chinky chinky Chinaman?
I think we did, yeah, uh-huh. Which was really ironic.
Yes. What about going on to high school then? Were the new immigrants there as well?
Well, the school I went to, which was Tech, had maybe a handful of them, but by that time, they were pretty well accepted, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, at that time, it was quite acceptable to drive in a car to high school, you know. Mm-hmm. And because they excelled in math and physics, they were really in their element, as it were, much more so mm-hmm. than in grade 7 or 8.
You know. What happened to them? Were they able, did they go on to university, or, you know, did you?
I didn't really follow them up. I think I really lost track of them after the first year or two in high school, mm-hmm. you know.
Tech did, was there a lot, were there a lot of Chinese at Tech?
No, not really, mm-hmm. Because it was further away, so really I think you find the majority of Chinese going to Britannia High School yeah. rather than Tech, you know. As a matter of fact, I think at Britannia they had something like 80% population.
Why did you go to Tech?
Oh, it was personally because I indicated an interest in going into engineering. And they recommended Tech was the best place for engineering because you learn more of the technical aspects of engineering, math, and physics, and chemistry, that sort of thing.
What were you planning to be when?
I was going to be an aeronautical engineer. What happened? I think when I went to university, I sort of changed my mind and wanted to become a writer instead.
Did you go into university right after high school?
No, I worked for 2 or 3 years. Oh. Most of them was with Chinatown Youth.
Oh, that's when you worked for
Chinatown? That's when I worked with Chinatown.
How did you get on? I mean, how did you start there?
Oh, well, I started out initially selling advertisements. And then I graduated to doing layout work with the advertisements that I had sold. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went into writing, you see. So I wrote, like, for Chinatown Charlie, or I contributed items to Chinatown Charlie. And then I did have my own column.
What was the role of that particular magazine in the Chinese community?
Oh, well, it was an English language publication, and it came out every 2 weeks, and was really to inform the community, what went on. It was really, you know, it was just to say, you know, this is what went on in Chinatown itself. It's items that normally wouldn't get into the Vancouver Sun or the Province.
Who were the subscribers?
Oh, a lot of subscribers were business people, you know, because I remember a lot of merchants subscribed to it, and a lot of people that were living in Chinatown subscribed to it. And there were people across Canada and the United States that subscribed to it, believe it or not, you know. But then that was because Roy Ma would reprint articles, say, from the Toronto or Montreal newspaper or San Francisco, you know, that sort of thing.
When you were growing up, did you belong to any organizations in Chinatown?
No, I think probably the only thing closest I joined was the old Pender Y, and that was like a social center. Actually, I guess it served more like a community center than anything else, mm-hmm. because I had belonged to a boys' club, which met every Friday night, and just by coincidence, the girls also had a girls' club, and they met every Friday night, and somehow we always managed to get together, and we would have dances like at Halloween or Christmas time, you know. And it was a nice sociable thing. Yeah, it was great. And of course it was open to the community. And we met a lot of of our friends that we normally wouldn't see at our own high school, you know, like because some of the Chinese would have attended King Edward, well, most of them would have attended King Edward Britannia and Tet. So this was a good opportunity, like, to see them at least once a week or whenever we had a dance function.
So was it only Chinese going to the Y?
Pretty well, yeah. Pretty well, yeah. I would say about 80 or 90% of us. Yeah, it was all Chinese, so.
So you would go to high school and you would have, I guess, white friends there, but then you'd still,
Yeah.
have a circle of Chinese friends.
That's right. And I think, yeah, that's right, we did. And also, there was a bowling club going on, too, because I remember that time we had a bowling alley underneath what used to be the Asian Gardens, or the Asian Garden used to be the bowling alley, you know. And that was another big social activity, too, in those days. And it sort of kept the community together, as it were, you know, like there was that link.
Did it feel funny having sort of one group of friends at school and then another group of friends in Chinatown that was sort of you would have white friends at school and then Chinese friends here in Chinatown?
Personally, I just sort of accepted it as being quite normal, you know, and it didn't really make me feel more aware of anything else. I think the only time I would feel more Chinese was when I was going to Strathcona, but after you get home, you have to go back up to Chinese language school at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, and you put in another 2 hours in the school setting, and I continued that in the first year or two of high school, but then after that, I sort of gave it up, or my father gave me up, this saying that after all these years of going to Chinese school, you still haven't learned how to speak Chinese.
Was that true? You weren't learning
Pretty
anything?
well, yeah, pretty well. I think what was confusing was that what they taught in Chinese language school was slightly different from the Chinese language my father spoke to me, you know. So it was a little different. It was very confusing for me, I thought, at that time, you know.
You
And
he spoke what, a dialect at home?
sure, yeah. Yeah, he would spoke, he, well, he would speak Lungdu, or else he would speak Seyup, you know.
What would you say was the general attitude of kids in your generation towards Chinese school?
I think we all hated it. The fun part was where we played ping pong, you know. And but other than that, we hated it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was funny. I think a lot of us that had a tendency at that time to forget our heritage, you know. And now that we're a few years older, you know, we have a tendency to regret it.
And so you started university when? When did you start university?
Well, I entered university, let me see, I think it was 1959, because I left Tech in 57 and worked for 2 years, so I entered university in 1959. So I was 2 years behind my regular friends who went on to university right from high school. I thought it was well worth the 2 years because, first of all, I didn't know what to do if I were to go to university. And working for the 2 years after high school was a good experience. You know, because I learned how to become a little more independent, you know, make my own money. Mind you, I was living at home, but the fact was that I was saving up to go to university because my father really couldn't afford to send me to university anyways, you know. So it had several advantages, you know. And then when I got to university, I decided that I didn't want to be an engineer. I had to take a general arts course, and more specifically, I wanted to become a writer at that time, you know. So I majored in psychology and creative writing.
That was unusual.
Yeah, it was unusual. At that time, it was a logical choice. Although, mind you, I spent a lot more time in my writing assignments than anything else. And one of the clubs that I joined was a photography club, so I used to spend quite a bit of time in the dark room at Brock Hall. Like my last lecture might be at 4 o'clock, so first thing I would do is go down to Brock Hall, and I wouldn't be out of that building until 10 o'clock at night, you know, because I spent so much time doing dark room work.
What did your father think of you doing a non-professional kind of degree?
He didn't like it.
What did he say?
It was a waste of time. He says, "You're better off running a grocery store or working in a grocery store, you know, because he always said people always have to eat, so you know, work in a grocery store, you know, you never can go wrong with that, you know. So.
Was he worried that you wouldn't be able to find work after your degree?
Well, I know my older brother, he got my father to try to discourage me from going on university because at that time, my brother had just gotten his degree, but he was discouraged when he was looking for a job. And I guess in his own way, he was trying to discourage me from going through the same experience.
What happened to him?
Well, he went on to bigger and better things, you know, but
He had a degree in what?
oh, he had a degree in political
And then he
science.
tried to find work here.
Yeah, and then he went down to Seattle and got his master's in political science and international law. And then he went to New York and got his PhD. And he started working with the United Nations right after he got his PhD. So he did quite well. But I think at the point when he was in between degrees, he was discouraging my father that I shouldn't go to university at all. Which was really difficult to take at that time, you know.
Were most of your contemporaries going on to university?
Yes, quite a number of them did. Yeah. Some, you know, some of them end up being pharmacists, lawyers, social workers. Yeah. It was interesting because they all went and learned a particular trade or profession, and I think what I really wanted to go into university was for an education. I think my values were slightly old-fashioned at that time. I think I just really want to get a universal education.
Yeah.
Universal in the sense that, you know, I like to know everything about everything, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, because normally Chinese people are much more pragmatic. They sort of, you go to university and you learn a trade and you get a job and things fit.
Yeah, I think being the youngest in the family, I think at that time I was hanging loose, as it were, you know. And I think it was also the spirit of the 50s and 60s, too, at that time, you know. Because I think you were sort of coming into a young movement, as it were, like the flower generation, the flower child generation type thing, you know. Mind you, I wasn't involved in peace marches and stuff like that, but I came very close with those people that were involved in that time, you know.
Yeah, I mean the 50s were a booming period, sort of there was sort of a lot of opportunity around.
Yeah, that was another reason why I guess I didn't really take the serious concern about, you know, taking a profession, you know. Yeah, that's true. There were a lot more job opportunities available then, and I think at that time when you went in with a job, you more or less went on strength of experience rather than an academic background, you know, which is what they require now. Academic background, they don't really care about your experience, you know.
Was Chinatown changing in the mid fifth, you know, in the 50s and 60s and the early 60s?
Yeah, I think so. I remember a lot of the, well, let me put it this way. I remember when I was at the Y, they used to have these Chinatown tours. And they would have it once a year so they can raise money for the local Y. And it was really interesting because one year I was in charge of coordinating the tour. Like I had to go to the different merchants and arrange for them that I would take a group of 15 or 20 people through them, you know. And of course, the people that were on the tour were Seiyan, and almost invariably, someone would say, you know, where are the tunnels in Chinatown? Because somewhere along the line, they read that, you know, there are tunnels underneath Chinatown, which I think was more of an American conception than anything else. The closest I can think of a tunnel in the Chinatown are those large storage rooms underneath. The storefronts in Chinatown, you know, but they're not really connecting tunnels. But that was a real funny thing. But at that time in Chinatown, it was so small, everyone knew one another. And like, for example, you can walk down the street and you can see a lot of these elderly Chinese standing on the street, and they'll be talking to each other, enjoying the sun. There was no real hustle and bustle, but they knew everyone that walked down Chinatown. And these were the people that were like close to their, well, I guess they were retired, really. They would probably be in their 60s or 70s, you know. And they knew everyone. And they knew who the young ones were, and they knew who were the new arrivals were. But there was a closeness in Chinatown. You really knew who your neighbors were, you know. It was really interesting. Like at that time, my father was Secretary Treasurer of Chinese Development Association. And it was interesting because he used to have members come in asking him for loans. And he would either, you know, give them a handout or he would turn them down. But they used to come to him. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that everyone did know one another, and there was a bit of a closeness involved there. But then, I guess gradually, what happened too was with Chinatown, you start to have an influx of new business. Because I remember one time, some of the restaurants and some of the business were starting to go downhill, you know. And then I guess they started getting new influx of money and with new businesses and so on. And so that some of the restaurants that you see, like I mentioned, like the New Peking and the Bamboo Terrace, you know, they were gone. And others took its place. Like for example, where the New Peking used to be is now, I think it's the Bank of Montreal. Where the Bamboo Terrace was is now another restaurant, and I think it's a wicker furniture store
Yeah.
down
When
below.
was this decline? What year would you say it was?
I think it was probably in the mid. Well, yeah, either in the mid or late 60s.
Mid or late
Yeah,
60s.
yeah. Yeah, it really changed. I think too, like the generation that was like Fun Sen, for example. Like, see, his decline was towards the late 50s, and he was sort of like the unofficial mayor of Chinatown. He was really well known, and he was well respected at that time, anyways. And it was really funny because I remember. Like, because he was the head of Chinese Development Association for such a long time, you sort of had a tendency to say, wow, you know, this is where we're going. But then when he retired, certain things started to change because, you know, the question was, gee, who's going to take over, you know, the Chinese Benevolent Association? Also at that time, should we or should we not recognize China? Because, you know, China wasn't really officially recognized. And that sort of split Chinatown into two political groups. You know, you have the Kuomintang that says, oh, forget about it, you know. And then you have the others that said, you know, it may not be too bad of an idea to recognize China. So there was sort of like a political change there as well.
What about all those stories about the illegal immigrants during the in the mid-50s up to the early 60s? The newspapers came up with these big expose kinds of stories about all
Yeah.
these thousands of illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
How what was what was that true, and what was the reaction in the community like? Or in your anyways, for you anyways, as a native born, it was, you know.
Yeah, well, well, from my own experience, yeah, I would say that the newspaper did sensationalize it, but really, basically, what they wrote was quite true. What happened was that the law wouldn't allow, you know, certain class of immigrant in. But, you know, it was a desperate situation. And certainly people were making money on it too. There was no question about it, you know. Birth certificates were being sold, like Canadian birth certificates were being sold. And yeah, you know, there was a lot of controversy about it. And of course, once the press got hold of it and they were very critical, the Chinese or the Chinese community was very sensitive to it, which is quite understandable, you know. But it was also a means for them to bring their family over, and what other means do you have, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question because, you know, it was a wrong committed by the Chinese, and it's sort of embarrassing to the Chinese, and yet, I mean, in strict legal facts, it's illegal, but in terms of the overall picture, you know, of greater, it's caused by white Canada and the kind of laws that were passed against the Chinese.
Oh yeah, you know, because like the white society had always discriminated against the Chinese, you know, like when they imposed head tax on the Chinese in the late 19th
Yeah.
century.
Was there much racism in the 50s? In the 60s?
Yeah, oh yeah, there was. Like I remember, for example, when my sister applied for a job at a restaurant at a place called Arbutus Village at 16th and Arbutus, you know, she just wanted to get a job as a waitress. But they turned her down because she was Chinese and they didn't want anyone working there that belonged to a minority group. When I graduated from high school, which was in 57, I went down to the Bank of Montreal on Pender Street and asked for a job as a teller. And that time the manager, Tommy Marr, said, "Well, can you speak Chinese?" And I said, "No, I can't." But I said, "You know, what's the difference, you know?" So Tommy Marr said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll send you to the head office over at Pender and Granville." So I did and talked to the personnel people there. And they still asked me the same question, "Can you speak Chinese?" And I said, "No. If I did, I suppose I'd be working only in the Chinatown branch." And they said, "Yeah, that's right." And I said, "Well, what's wrong with my not working at some other branch elsewhere in the city?" And they said, "Well, it's because some of our customers may not like dealing with a Chinese person." You know, boy, that really, it really threw me off. And for a very long time, and I had no dealings with Bank of Montreal, whatever, you know. But that was part of their practice. Unfortunately, I was too early in applying for a job because I think about 2, 3 years after that, they changed the law, you know. And I think the bank itself recognized that too. And I think they did change their hiring policy a few years after that. But yeah, there were certain discrimination. And if you walk down the street, you know, people would sometimes will call you names, you know, Chinky Chinky Chinaman or whatever, you know. And but I guess the easiest way of accepting it is what Roy Ma used to tell me. You know, Roy Ma from Chinatown News. He said, "Well, just think of them as being very ignorant."
Think of it what?
just think of them as being rather ignorant
Rather
because
ignorant, yeah.
they don't know what they're talking about. You know. And I guess that was the best way to look at it, you know. And you just sort of shrug off the prejudice, you know.
It's an interesting period because on one hand, if you read the newspapers of that time, there's a lot of people saying, you know, brotherhood and equality and we should do this. You know, the labor unions are coming out with great, you know, declarations and, you know, the Chinese have the vote. But, you know, so there's this one level where people are saying, you know, the Chinese, you know, the situation is improving greatly. But in reality, I've always wondered, you know, how much change is going on in the 50s and 60s. I've always wondered.
Well, you're quite right in that observation. You're quite right in the sense that, you know, there was this tendency to say, "Oh, everything is all right, and you know, the race should get together, and we're all living in the same land or the same society, and so on." But I think you find that you find this idealism at any place, and it just happens to apply in our society. And it really, what it is the is a very macro level or macro viewpoint. And I think the intention is that for it to sink downwards rather than from grassroots going up. And I think that if you say it long enough, eventually you reach the ears that are young enough to believe in it. And I think for a time being, I think for a time there was, because believe it or not, like although there was a fair amount of prejudice in the 40s and 50s, I noticed like towards the 60s and 70s, although it was a little more subtle, like particularly like with job practice or job interviews. Because mind you, at that time too, they were passing laws too about you know, you don't discriminate in hiring and so on. But they would do it in very subtle manners. But just the same, Eventually, it does sink in, but it takes maybe a period of 10 or 20 years, you know, before it really sinks through. And until now, like, really, in this day and age, you don't really have that prejudice anymore, you know.
What kind of a reputation did Chinatown have in those days in terms of this for the city to look at Chinatown in the 50s? What was its reputation?
Well, the only thing is, one word that came to mind was sleazy, I suppose, because for one thing, Penner Street being so close to Penner's or to Hastings Street, on Hastings Street you get a lot of loggers, dope addicts, and prostitutes, you know, and because it's so close to Penner, you associate Chinatown with those elements. The other thing was that there used to be a nightclub right at the corner of Pender and Main, and it used to be called the Kupla Khan. I believe now it's Khan, the Trust Building, you know. But at that time, they had real loud music, and they used to have all sorts of, you know, people going to this nightclub. And almost invariably, you attract, you know, the wrong type of elements. You get drunkards, you get prostitutes, and so on. And not only that, but half a block further down on Main Street, there was an upstairs restaurant or nightclub. And I can't remember what it was called now. I think it was called Bombay or something like that. I
This is
can't.
on Pender Street?
Yeah, no, on Main.
Okay, just a minute.